Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Hello, monkeys. How are you? Hey, may the 4th be with you. Yep. And that's about enough of that before we get some sort of cease and desist or just outright dragged into court. Well, happy Star Wars Day, everybody. And what better day to have another special edition of Go To Movies on the Snark Monkey podcast than today, with the voice of Obi-Wan Kenobi himself in the Clone Wars and the animated features, James Arnold Taylor. He's also Ratchet and Ratchet and Clank and Tidus in Final Fantasy X, and he's Johnny Test and a whole bunch of other voices, many of them inside his head, and sometimes they come out his mouth. What? Also a very good friend from way back, and we get into that, but we're also talking about his comfort food movie. And even though today is Star Wars Day and Star Wars The Clone Wars will be wrapping up, we don't talk about a Star Wars movie. His comfort food movie today that we talk about is a romantic comedy starring Albert Brooks, directed by Albert Brooks, co-starring Meryl Streep, 1991's Defending Your Life. It's good. Oh, it was a great excuse for me to go back and rewatch this delightful romantic comedy taking place once again in the afterlife. Seems to be a theme going here with these go-to movies and my guests. So let's get into it and head to a long time ago. No. It's go-to movies time, Defending Your Life with James Arnold Taylor. So how are we going to start? Who's going to start? What are we starting? Is this it? Has this been the whole podcast?
I've got to go.
Okay, bye.
That's all you get. Let's do yours.
All right.
So you just, start however you want. I'm so excited. I have lists and lists of things, movies and things. I know you only want one, but...
Well, we're going to talk. I want to talk at length about Defending Your Life because that was the one you brought up. But I also want to hear your other ones.
Yeah. All right. Well, you just go. You want to start? You go ahead and do your thing.
All right. I feel like we started. We had such great material there at the beginning. We were on a roll, James, and then me trying to start the podcast. It's screeching to a freaking halt.
Yeah.
Dude.
Just all crap.
I wish I was good at this. Ladies and gentlemen, we are here today in this strange, strange time. And I have had the pleasure of being in touch with folks in the creative community who also happen to have been previous guests on my Snark Monkey podcast. As a matter of fact, this gentleman was my very first guest on Snark Monkey way back in the day in the mid-2000s or whenever, 2010s, whenever it was. He is the voice of Obi-Wan Kenobi on The Clone Wars. He is the voice of The Flash and Dummy in Lego DC Shazam Magic and Monsters. He is the voice of Tidus in Final Fantasy VII?
Ten.
Damn.
Ten.
He's a bunch of things, and he's a wonderful human being who I have known forever. He is a brilliant comedian and actor and voice person and a fine family man, And pretty easy on the eyes. James Arnold Taylor, everybody.
Hey, well, you know, you are one of my, and this is not bad, oldest friends.
Oh, wow.
What does that mean?
That hurt.
No, meaning you're not your age, but long running. You're one of my longest running friends, because most people don't really like me, but also because...
I'm not going to dispute that, but...
Yeah, sorry. I know. There was a big thing of air there.
It's not. You're a big thing of air. Right back at you, man. Okay, we are on the wrong foot.
But man, here's the thing that people don't know, though, is before we actually started recording, you and I, the first word you said triggered a bit that went into like a 60-second bit that we didn't, that without missing a beat, that we hadn't done in, I think, 20 years.
Yeah, it had to have been. Stan and Larry. Yeah. Which is not even a bit that I helped you create, but I helped you continue, and
right.
And it will forever be a part of. And the ironic thing is, we played Stan and Larry, and I was Stan, and you became Larry. So my emails to you typically start out Larry, Larry, Larry,
and then I reply Stan, Stan,
and then we just go from there.
Because Stan and Larry was based off of a clothing commercial in the 90s by Sam and Libby. And they had these very, like, you remember the Dockers with pants and all you saw were the pants? Remember Seinfeld? I hate that commercial. It was basically one of those kind of hipster, yuppie commercials about clothing. And they were just, like, so cool. And I made this parody of it with my old writing partner, Pete Hansen. And we called it Stan and Larry. And it was two guys, because we were two guys instead of a guy and a girl. And then Pete no longer worked where I was working with you, and you were my big boss. And so you just fell right into the character.
Well, you invited me. I would have never deigned myself worthy of just jumping in like that, but you...
Oh, no. It was, and no one ever noticed.
No one noticed. Yeah. Well, I had been such a fan, and I had been listening to it forever, so I was already... like in the groove, like I hit the ground running. I knew exactly what I wanted to do, and just following your lead.
I should have got some of them. Maybe I'll send you some of them, because I have all of them. I have every Stan and Larry.
Yeah, you
still
have everything archived. But James and I go back to the day of back when radio comedy was funny, and we were creating it for radio stations around the country. That entire time, what's that?
Yeah. I wonder if people, like the young folks listening, really even understand that, because they listen to podcasts.
Yeah.
But what we did, I wonder, because they were these weird little comedy bits and fake commercials
right.
and stuff. Would they even understand it?
Not
to insinuate people aren't smart enough to get it.
No, I think you're saying that people are stupid and don't understand the concept. I mean, basically what we were trying to do was Saturday Night Live for the radio every single day
and
never stop. We created running characters. We created parody commercials, parody songs, and James and for a while his partner Pete and I and Rob the Iceman Eisenberg, and there was this just kind of like it was the ultimate ragtag group of comedy brethren, and we were
Oscar nominated writer Alan Wankus.
Yes, exactly, for Straight Outta Compton, indeed. Mm-hmm. And also through, you know, at various phases, Jimmy Kimmel went through there, Adam Carolla went through there, a number of folks from the UCB Theater who are now on TV and in film went through there. And at the time, we were all haunting these studios in the Valley in Los Angeles, just like pooping out comedy constantly. It was just...
Is that what we did?
That's it. Yeah. Ooh. It was like, you know, if you opened up the Willy Wonka doors and instead of a chocolate stream, it was a comedy poop stream.
Wow.
Yeah. Did I bring it to life?
That's never been explained like that, but I guess I feel better.
It's appropriate.
I think, like, what I say to people is, Saturday Night Live, you like all this stuff on Saturday Night Live, that's basically what we did for the radio, right?
Yeah, yeah. But
that's
we did
the
it
easiest way of saying.
Constantly. It was
Constant.
It was daily grind of, and it never stopped. We did not get week-long breaks to stop it, because radio goes on around the clock, and we were supplying
right.
a huge volume of material. But what my point,
and a half years. Yeah.
The point I was going to make, though, was that through that entire time, and this is the absolute truth, and I'm not just kissing your butt because you're here, but this was absolutely true. There couldn't have been more times when we were all working together where we, behind your back, are going, all of us, we're going, why isn't James like famous, right? Why isn't he doing every cartoon? And even you were going, why aren't I famous? And if there was anybody who was destined to do what he's doing now, it was James. And it was just so clear to us. And it was frustrating to us and frustrating to you when you couldn't get that breakthrough. And when it came, I think all of the rest of us were like, finally, it's just people figured it out.
The number one star in the world. Bang. You hear me?
Yeah.
Thank you. That is incredibly kind of you to say. And it's just one of those things where ever since I was 4 years old, I wanted to do voices in cartoons.
Yeah.
I wanted to entertain people with my voices, and I did these weird characters and stuff. And so I just tried and tried and tried. And that's where people go, oh, voiceover, that's big and that's easy to get into. It's like, no, it takes a long time, even for somebody that is working in. I worked in radio for, you know, well over a decade before getting into voiceover to where I was known or working on shows and stuff. So,
you were knocking on that door for a long time. And if you would like to hear the origin story of James Arnold Taylor, we go into great detail. I'm sure James has talked about it on his own YouTube channel and on his own podcast.
My podcast and stuff,
But yeah, if you want to hear kind of the Snark Monkey version of the James Arnold Taylor story, it's our very first episode. If you go back in the feed anywhere, if you search Snark Monkey in your podcast and check out episode number one, he is there. But the reason I have James here today is because I reached out. I have been reaching out, and so many people have been so kind to respond because we're in a weird time. And if there was ever a time where we need the comfort and joy of something that we can all share together, because so many of us are trapped in our homes with our family members and or our loved ones. And and one of the things, in addition to consuming a lot of new content, because we might have a little more time, is kind of going back to some of the things that we love and maybe sharing them with our family or with our kids and who haven't seen these things yet. And it's interesting, the first movie that you came up with when I asked you about this go-to movie concept was Defending Your Life, the Albert Brooks film from 1991. And I should have immediately responded, who is that? Albert Brooks, the comedian, director, Albert Brooks. Who is that? That's such an inside joke.
That's an inside joke, which I almost was going to put that movie as mine just to be
just
funny.
To make us watch it. James and I, in the early 2000s, made a mockumentary called The Comedy Team of Pete and James, which is a real thing that exists, and
it's on my YouTube channel.
It's also on James's YouTube channel in full if you want to see something that, to this day, it amazes me that we were able to pull off what we did with nothing.
Ahead of our time. I mean, because that was just like, you know, prosumer cameras. They were almost pro, but not totally, but they were, because that's the best you could get.
Yeah, we were retrofitted the camera to be wide angle, to be like boxed, letterboxed, because
like widescreen.
We didn't have the ability to do that in camera, so we did it in post. And just remember the rendering time from scene to scene.
We had the first Apple computers that could bring video in, and you could use iMovie and Final Cut Pro. And so we were cutting on both. We took a class for Final Cut Pro.
That's right.
That
that's
we went,
right.
Like one afternoon, we went to some like strip mall, and there was like this store we went in, and we learned how to do Final Cut
Pro. We took a class to edit on film.
So now you got your video there. Now hit the button.
Which, by the way,
see what you done?
We took the class even though we had already started the movie. So we were actually like learning in the moment. Anyway, but there is a line in the film where James, as the main character, is doing stand-up on his own. He's doing impressions, which is his specialty, and he does a little bit from Albert Brooks' movie Modern Romance, a great line, which I believe to this day is an influential line of comedy, because he, at the time that he made that movie, he broke the rule of threes. And made it the rule of two, and now that is very common in comedy. And can you do the line, James?
This is a no-win situation. You've never heard of a no-win situation? Vietnam, this.
Now, that's a fantastic piece of writing because the rule forever was you want to have a list of things. You go this, this, and then the punchline. And Albert Brooks, in his brilliance, his subtle brilliance, went, compared their romance to Vietnam, this. That's freaking great.
Yeah. And he made it work because of his delivery and because of his commitment to it. But you're right. That is so true. It's always one, two, three, comedy. Yeah. You know, but he did one comedy, basically. Yeah. One, two, comedy.
So James and I both already fans of Albert Brooks. And I'm afraid, James, that Albert Brooks might be one of those kind of brilliant comedy names that may be lost to some generations because he's still around. He's still alive. Yeah. He's still extremely funny. He's one of my favorite Twitter follows because he's still just got one of the sharpest writing minds.
Yeah. Same with me. And here's where people may know him. Finding Nemo. Yeah, I'm looking for my son, Nemo.
Yes.
Nemo, it's me. I can't remember. What's his name in that movie?
Dad.
I'll look it up. Dad. He's the dad fish.
Yeah.
That's Albert Brooks.
And he's a great voice actor. I mean, that's a great point. I mean, the last time I've seen him in any sort of movie role that stuck was he was a great bad guy in the movie Drive with Ryan Gosling.
Wasn't he fantastic?
He was great. And I can't believe that hasn't given him like a Tarantino style, you know, second act in his acting.
Because he is, but he's a tortured soul, I think, himself as a person. And so, you know, he's got to believe that he's good enough. And his brother was Super Dave Osborne.
Bob Einstein,
who recently passed away, God rest his soul. And they were, so his real name is Albert Einstein.
So you know why he changed his name for comedy. So Albert,
I'm sorry, Larry. The one thing I will tell you though is, I don't want to jump ahead, but we showed Defending Your Life recently to my daughter because of all of this, you know, like watching something comfort food, and she loved it, and she loved him. So all I say is, there's hope that the young people, if they find him and see him and watch his movies, they may just fall in love with him.
Well, here's why I was so fascinated to see this recommendation is because, well, for two things. One, it is not an uncommon recommendation right now. I did a search on the Google machine for comfort food movies and also included Defending Your Life. And a number of people have said, this is a good time to go back and revisit this movie. And after rewatching it just over the last couple of days, I see why. It is so delightful, so heartwarming, so life-affirming for something that takes place in the afterlife. It's really genuinely warmly funny. It may not be my favorite Albert Brooks movie because he had the ability to be very biting, and you know, his movies can be very dark, and that's why this was such a departure when it came out, and also maybe why it was kind of a much bigger hit when it came out than any of his other movies.
It was more of a studio movie, wasn't it?
Yeah.
For him, it was a studio movie.
But it was still his sense of humor and his take on things. But and you know, there is some irreverency to it, but there's also this just it wraps up in such a warm way that is so satisfying. So the other interesting point that you picked it is that my first go-to movie was with my good friend Pete Siegel, the film director. Right. He chose the movie Heaven Can Wait.
Heaven Can Wait. I love that movie.
Which is another movie about the afterlife. And it's so interesting. I mean, it's just that's kind of a coincidence, but it's also an interesting thing to be thinking about. Maybe we're all a little bit more, you know, we're kind of reaching for that. You know, what is our connection between this world and what might come? I don't know if we're being a little more introspective, or maybe we find some comfort in the idea of something just beyond where we are right now. I'm not deep enough to kind of figure that out. But a lot of people are kind of picking these movies that have almost fantastical elements, but are also grounded in something that is connected to faith, I guess, is for lack of a better term.
And you know, the funny thing about it, well, the whole theme of that movie is fear and overcoming fear.
Yes. Let's get to that. Let's go over the movie. And I also want to get your other recommendations, because I can imagine with your vast library and also things you love, I want to hear about that in a little bit. But let's talk about Defending Your Life, since that's the one you picked. And by the way, I think both James and I can wholeheartedly recommend this as for the entire family, not maybe little kids, but there's nothing truly kind of objectionable in the movie, but it's a little adult from the standpoint of just it may bore small children. But I think if you have a young teen to teenager and they're willing to sit with you through a lovely little, it's essentially a romantic comedy. I mean,
it really is.
It's just a love story.
My 15-year-old daughter loved it, and she was, she may have been 14 when she first saw it, and she just loved it. And we quote it now back and forth.
Let's see. It's Albert Brooks and, bury the lead.
Meryl's small name.
Yeah, Meryl Streep. Who they, like, doesn't even show up until, like, 20 minutes into the movie.
And the funny thing is Meryl Streep, you know, one of our greatest actresses of the time, of our day, and she's done so many brilliant movies and Oscars and all that. This is my favorite of her movies. She's so good in this because she's so relaxed in it.
It's such a departure for her because I don't believe she had really done many, if any, comedies up to this point. And
not to this degree. Not like this. Yeah.
And she is absolutely lovely in it and perfect. And apparently, once she was cast, I mean, she was actually asked by Albert to be in it, and he had absolutely no thought that she would say yes. And when she did, he went back and rewrote the script so it would fit her better. Because once he knew that Meryl Streep was going to be in it, he said, I heard her voice, and I felt her rhythms of her speech, and I had to change the character to match what I thought she could do. And to his credit, it's perfect, because it's not like she's not trying to be something different. She's not trying to be funny. She is just absolutely perfect in the role. So Albert Brooks plays Daniel, who is an LA advertising executive. It's established very quickly. He's not a bad guy. And that's what's interesting about the tone of the movie, is that he doesn't play a reprehensible character who needs his comeuppance or something.
Not at all.
He's
not
just kind
very
of
normal.
Yeah, he's a fairly normal guy, but maybe he's made some
neurotic.
Yeah, exactly. And also, you know, he's kind of pushed people away, maybe, and been afraid to, like you said, had the fear of taking some chances. But he's worked his way up, and he's doing well. He dies within the first few minutes in a car accident on his birthday.
On his birthday,
and is sent to Judgment City, which is this kind of very stark, pristine way station, essentially.
Not
very much like
hell.
It was just a place, basically, where what he finds out, and it's literally called Judgment City, because it is decided at that point what your next step is going to be, whether you are going to have to go back and try again on Earth, or whether you get to move on, as they would say. And so you would literally have to go into these courtrooms to defend your life, to
and
find
they play
out.
You scenes, clips of your life, like you're watching a movie, like your life is a movie. So many of us think sometimes our lives are like a movie. In this, he actually gets to look at his life like a film, and it's great.
And Albert Brooks' character is very luckily being assigned his attorney, his defender, the great Rip Torn.
Pete and I had a chance back when we worked in radio. We got a chance to interview Rip Torn and talk to him for a Larry Sanders press junket. And the first thing we said to him is, when we die, we want you as our attorney. And he was so touched. He said, that was the greatest movie I've ever done. I was so thrilled. And he wanted to just talk about that. He loved Larry Sanders Show, but he was like, oh my gosh, if I could just sit and talk about Defending Your Life, what an experience it was.
Yeah.
He just loved it. And he was brilliant.
He's great. I mean, Rip Torn is just Rip Torn, no matter what he does. Yeah. But nobody does Rip Torn as well as Rip Torn. And so it's the perfect role for him. And honestly, he's one of the few kind of recognizable character actor faces in the movie. There's not a lot of stunt casting. You don't see a whole lot of comedy people
Buck
in
Henry,
there.
Maybe.
Buck Henry shows up in very briefly. It's funny because Buck Henry is fifth billed on the poster.
and he's in the movie for like 2 minutes. It's really strange.
Oh, but he's hysterical.
He's so good. And Oscar winner and Emmy winner Lee Grant is the tough as nails prosecuting attorney, I guess the best word you can use.
Yeah, the prosecutor,
who is essentially trying to prove that Daniel's time on Earth was not very well spent and he should go back and try again because he gave in to his fears too often. And that's what's so interesting about the tone of the movie, and I think it's where Albert was absolutely brilliant, is that, and you brought this up earlier, James, and I want you to talk a little bit about this, because it's really not about, they're not looking back on parts of his life where he did bad things. This is, and this movie doesn't even approach things that way. It's more about missed opportunities based upon the fears you had about standing up for yourself and moving forward. And I got to think that that's part of the success of this movie, is that you don't dislike Albert Brooks' character. You're just a little kind of wishy-washy on him because that's how he's lived his life, it seems.
Yeah, there's times you get frustrated with him, but isn't that what we do with ourselves? Right. We get frustrated after we do something. Why did I do that? You know, and we become that kind of, just like him. You know, why am I doing this? Oh, great. You know, and that they have this montage of, you know, all these simple mistakes he's made, which is one of the funniest montages in movie history.
It is so good. It is. Do you remember the clips in the montage? I mean,
some of the clips are like one of them. He's in his car with a coat hanger, and he's locked in the car, trying to get out with the coat hanger, which makes absolutely no sense.
Yeah, he gives up almost immediately. There's also a moment where he, I think it's a chainsaw that he, you know, pulls the ripcord on, and it immediately throws him around in a circle, and he cuts the umbrella
on the
patio furniture in half. And these are all super quick. They go by and they just build and build and build and end with that stuck inside the car trying to get out with a coat hanger, which is like, what?
What does that even mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, but his whole life has been about fear, and yet he can't really even say what the fear is. And I think that you know, I literally earlier today was on the phone with a friend of mine who kind of is the walking epitome of Albert Brooks in this. But, and I mean that in a good way. He's a great guy, but he is very kind of, oh, sure, it's just me, you know, kind of a thing.
Right.
But this assumption that we all have that everybody else has it better than me, in as far, not as better than me, like, oh, they've got more than me, but that they know what they're doing more than I do.
Right.
I'm an idiot. Everybody else isn't.
Or they deserve it and I don't, or yes. And that's what's so powerful about this thing, is that really, if you're really locked into this movie and this character, he's portraying you. And that's where we get, it can enter into this story, that I recognize myself in Daniel. I recognize where, if I were being, and you can't help while watching this movie how would I respond in this situation? If I were to look back at my life and people were to show these clips of my life, what would they see me doing? Would they see me holding back in these opportunities? Would they see me, you know, not saying I love you to somebody who I should have said? Did I not give
myself?
Yeah. Did I not stand up for myself? Give myself enough credit? You can't help but put yourself in that situation, which I think also creates a conversation after a movie, which makes it that much more resonant for people.
Which is what movies were supposed to originally, I think, be about, to give us something to talk about. Like, I mean, the scenes in it are very much ones that every single person can relate to. It starts with him as a little kid and being picked on in the playground, and he should have stood up for himself. And if he hadn't, it kind of plagued his whole life, that why didn't I stand up to that bully?
Yeah.
You know, or lying to his parents about something because he's trying to save one friend, but then he cracks under pressure when his parents, you know, go to take away television from him. So these are all things we can relate to. And then it folds over even into his time there with Meryl Streep's character and being strong enough and not fearful. I mean, that certainly is a thing that we're all dealing with right now.
Right.
What ifs?
Well, that's
so maybe that's why.
That's the brilliance of it, because so much of it is about his character is being shown here, again, not as somebody who has made bad choices, but somebody who is at heart trying to do the right thing and then doesn't follow through.
Made safe choices.
Yes.
Choices that were too safe.
Because taking any sort of chance or risk means that you're making yourself vulnerable. It reminds me a lot of what the Brené Brown has been talking about as far as vulnerability, where being vulnerable, opening up to vulnerability is also a strength. That accepting the fact that you are vulnerable and embracing that is your strength. And that's one thing that this character, and again, we're talking about a comedy here. This is a very funny movie, but it has so much of that nuance. And we should also say Meryl Streep's character, on the other hand, she's the balance for Daniel. She is the one who has made all the, and again, she is not lifted up. It's done with so much subtlety. Again, she's sketched very lightly. She has made great choices. She's done really valuable things in her life, but she's not some sort of hero.
Superhuman.
Yeah.
In fact, the way she dies, which we won't give away, even just adds to that.
Right.
Because...
and she's also not full of herself at all. She doesn't take herself... She doesn't, put herself on a pedestal. And that's one way also where, as we see the two of them grow together and become close and actually start to fall in love over these few days that we see them together in Judgment City, that they can fit together, that there is some compatibility. The difference is, will Daniel have the strength and overcome the fear to go to the next step, whereas she is looking for somebody in her life or her afterlife who just makes her laugh, who things she says, this doesn't take any effort. That was one of her lines at one point.
Which is a beautiful part because it shows that people that we kind of perceive as all together still need people like us that we think are not that together.
Yeah.
That it really brings balance by having two people like that together, because she's also a relatable character.
Oh, yeah,
there's,
absolutely.
There's so much in her that you can relate to.
Yeah, she's not sketched so grandly. I mean, when we see, there are a few clips we see of her where she has saved children from a burning home and runs back in for the cat. And, you know, that's a very economical way of sketching the kind of person she is. And she's watching this kind of just with like, oh, I remember that. She's not trying to take any credit for it. She's not all pumped up or pompous about it. She's just like, yeah, oh, well, that was a thing I did. Yeah, I guess so. And everybody just loves her. It's
going
such a...
Going back to the cat was such a nice touch, the guy says.
Yes. So as she and Daniel begin to get closer, they're also coming closer to their final judgment after their cases. And in his near final act of fear, he does not follow through. And I think it's such an interesting thing for them to point out and for him to say is the reason he doesn't want to really connect. Essentially, what they're talking about is kind of taking the next step in the relationship, which is going to be intimate. And and he says that this is so lovely, I don't see how it could be better than this right now. And and that's, wow, that's a powerful thing to say. I mean, it hits me every time.
It speaks also to our fears and how our fears can actually judge us in that too, going, it can't get better than this, so don't bother.
Yeah.
And so many times in life, there are things that are better and we should bother, but that voice goes, no, stay comfortable.
Yeah.
Well,
also in the case of having a relationship with somebody, it's also, if I go this next step, it's also setting me up, again, vulnerability, to be heartbroken, because that's probably what I deserve. And I would prefer to stay here in this safe zone than have to feel pain. Whereas the approach should be, I have an opportunity here to experience such love and such joy with this amazing person. And I think that's why that scene is so heartbreaking to me, because he sees the opportunity to really experience something, but he's logically going, I don't know what's next. Nobody does. Are we even going to have the chance to be together after this? Why would I want to experience that pain of losing something? And he chooses the safer path, which is, I just want to remember how good this was, and that's it.
Yeah. And even though once he goes back to Earth, he won't remember it anyways.
Right.
I mean, that's the funny part too, is, you know, this movie does, you know, I'm a Christian. My faith is very different than this movie does, but because I don't believe in past lives or any of that.
Right.
But what I love about it is that it's all so relatable. The best things are the funny of it too, though. Like in Judgment City, you can eat however much you want and never gain weight. Now, I don't care what religion you are, that's a dream right there.
Well, that's a version of heaven for some people, I think. I mean, it's such a great running joke because it's one of the first things they tell you when you get to Judgment City is that no matter what you eat, it doesn't matter. You're not going to get, I think, when
and the food is wonderful.
Yes, too. Every bite
and fast
is the best you've ever had. And it's served immediately, and it's perfect, and it's amazing, and the portions are... That scene in the Italian restaurant with Meryl Streep and Albert Brooks and the Italian waiter is fantastic. You like a pie? I'm going to bring you 9 pies. you can take some home.
I'm going to make you shrimp. It's so fresh, it climbs up onto the plate for itself. You know, I mean, he is just so... And then everybody,
And Daniel's response to, do you want some shrimp? Do you like shrimp? Yeah. Is, I hear they're full of cholesterol. He says, I don't know what you're saying, but I'm going to bring you shrimp. It doesn't matter.
He doesn't know what cholesterol is. He doesn't care. He lives in Judgment City. Oh, and the pies. I brought you 9 pies.
Yeah.
One for every day. But he says, how many days are you looking at? He says, 9 days. Ooh.
His
reaction. Ooh.
Yeah. Every time he says he's in Judgment City for 9 days, I guess.
That's a long time.
Yeah. Apparently, that's a very long time.
The character actors he surrounds himself with in these scenes are brilliant.
Yeah, they're
just
great.
So funny. From the guy that's the car salesman before he dies, and he's on the phone with the woman, and he's going, she doesn't know what she's talking about. And all of that stuff. It's just so many funny people.
Yeah, and not the most recognizable faces. So the casting was brilliant. They didn't go to kind of these known character actors
cameos.
In every case. They are everyday types when you watch them, but they're all so good. And it's such a brilliant movie. There is one recognizable face, one big cameo at the Past Lives Pavilion.
Yes.
That is such a great casting choice.
And the response that they, you know, the people, you know, there's like, I always think about loop groups because I'm a voice actor. The loop group that must have had so much fun with that because there's that woman goes, oh my gosh. when you see this person, we won't give it away.
But, well, I remember in theaters, the reaction in theaters was one of, oh, yes.
Yes, of course.
The Past Lives Pavilion is a very funny gag. Because Albert, when you basically get to go in and you get to see all of the different lives that you've been sent back to Earth, you know, potentially a number of times, and who were you over time? And all of Albert's characters' past lives are people, a native running away from a lion. Or, I mean, do you remember?
Always, you know, what are you? Lunch, you know?
and he's yelling over to Meryl Streep, and he's like, who were you? And she's like, what was it?
Lancelot.
Yes, she was a knight. She was literally a knight in shining armor. Well, we should say it ends very happily in his last chance to prove that he can take a step beyond his fear. He sees his love, Meryl Streep's character, being taken away in what looks like a Universal Studios tram.
Wonder where they shot all that stuff too, though, because they did. This is before CG, so
there were some digital effects to block out some stuff because you can kind of see in these kind of stationary. We're talking about Judgment City, which is kind of this very not just pristine; it's just kind of a bland place. And that's another gag where Albert Brooks' character is staying at what is called the Continental, which looks like it was built in the 1970s and just kind of a very plain, drab, nice hotel.
Howard Johnson type
right.
hotel.
Well, Meryl's character, Julia, is staying at the Majestic, and it's just ornate and lush, and she's got a jacuzzi in her room.
The chocolates on the pillow are like swans and things.
But see if this makes sense to you. They shot this in a place that needed to look kind of as generic and pristine as possible, but still be familiar as a quote city to people, and they used Irvine, California. Scenes were shot at Mile Square Park in Fountain Valley, and then they used Irvine and Anaheim as the setting for most of the places. Yeah, so I thought that was
the
interesting.
Music as well. The music.
It's a beautiful score. It's a
really
great score.
Yeah. Very big and lush and lavish at parts and sweet and all moving. But yeah, when he is on those trams and stuff, it's really, it's quite a lot to look at for that time. That was 1991 that they did this. That's what I love about it. It's way before all this.
It's got a great look. And that actually leads me to a story. I do want to talk a little bit about the cinematographer for this film, which was a name that caught me. It didn't occur to me, I think, when I was originally watching the movie. So it was kind of surprising because it's not like some sort of, I mean, it's really well shot. But it's not some sort of stylized look. Things stay kind of very similarly lit throughout the movie, but it's a good looking movie. Don't get me wrong, but it was shot. The cinematographer was a man by the name of Alan, Davia.
Davia.
I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that, but I've been seeing his name forever. Now, Alan Davia, here's the story, James, and let me just kind of run through this real quick, but I think you'll find this fascinating.
Yeah.
Back in the 60s, Alan Davia was a buddy, a friend of a gentleman by the name of Steven Spielberg.
Who's that?
And Steven Spielberg was a filmmaker. Well,
I'm not familiar with
him. You can look up.
Okay.
They were buddies as film students back in the 60s. And Steven asked Alan to shoot this short film that he was raising money for. This was around the time that Steven Spielberg was crashing the gate at Universal and trying to get people to look at his 16 millimeter movies that he had shot. And they were all like patting him on the head going, yeah, you'll be a director one day. No problem. And he was so frustrated that he raised some money. He knew that he needed to shoot something in 35 millimeter widescreen that looked really good to catch their eye. So he raised something like $25,000, asked this other film student, Alan, to shoot it for him. It ended up being a 20-minute short called Amblin, which, as we all know, is the name of Steven Spielberg's longtime production company. Now, that was 1968, James.
Yep.
The next time Steven and Alan are working together, Alan Davia goes on to have a nice, respectable career, mostly doing television movies and a lot of television work. When he hears that Steven is looking for a cinematographer for his new movie, and it's going to have, you know, like kids in it and stuff, and he had just shot... a TV movie with Scott Baio called The Boy Who Drank Too Much.
Yes.
And he sent that to Steven Spielberg. And Spielberg apparently said, you know, they hadn't worked together since 68, right?
Yeah.
So it had been like almost 15 years. He said, I didn't even think twice. I asked Alan to shoot my next movie. And that movie was E.T., The Extraterrestrial. That was Alan Davia's first major motion picture. And tell me that that movie didn't set the tone for what every 80s movie should look like from that point, right?
Absolutely right. And then if you look at his, you know, The Twilight Zone, The Color Purple.
Yeah, he worked with Steven. Yeah. And Harry and the Hendersons, which was another 80s movie that is kind of seminal.
Absolutely.
And I mean, if you look at it at the way the Duffer Brothers recreate the 80s look for Stranger Things, that's Alan Davial's palette. That's his thing.
And that's the thing I like about Defending Your Life is it feels, even though it's 1991, it feels like the comedies I kind of grew up with in the 80s and even the 70s, it just has that feel.
Yeah.
And that's what's wonderful about it.
So one of the reasons I wanted to bring up Alan's name is that, one, I'm a big cinematographer geek. I know way too many of these guys' names, and I know their style and I know their look. It's something I've always been fascinated with. I also wanted to give him a shout out because not only did he direct some beautifully shot movies, including Bugsy and Avalon for Barry Levinson, and The Falcon and the Snowman for John Schlesinger, and worked for Spielberg. He also recently passed away as a result of complications from COVID-19. And so it's so interesting that you picked this movie and his name came up, because I have such an affection for what this man did with color and light and what he brought to my memory of great movies and what they were going to look like. And I don't think you can underestimate the look of film after he started working. And again, not that Steven Spielberg needs our, you know, help or co-sign on anything, but to have that vulnerability and lack of fear to say, I haven't worked with this guy since we shot a short out in the desert for nothing, but I trust him to make what has now become one of the most beloved movies of all time. So, salute to Alan Davion.
Yeah. God bless him. Yeah. It is very sad that he just recently passed. I don't know if you saw that on Wikipedia as well. It says that Steven Spielberg had just sent him a letter as well.
Yes. And it was something they read to him literally while he was on his deathbed several times. Yeah.
God bless him. Wow.
If you go and look up any, there is some great geeky stuff with Alan Davion talking about the times he's worked. He loved talking about working with Spielberg and is just such a great character. He grew up in Louisiana. He's got this just great vibrancy to him. It's just so sad, especially because of circumstances that, he was 77 when he passed away and had a very full life, I'm sure, but still probably lost much too soon. So a hats off to Alan Davion.
Absolutely.
Hey, one thing you mentioned in passing, James, and I know that you aren't hesitant to talk about it, but I'm curious because you are a person of faith. And that was another interesting thing I thought as I was watching this movie, because I do know folks who, I'm trying to kind of put this in the right way. I know folks who are very strong in their faith, but who resist watching representations of afterlife if they don't adhere to their more strict version of what they believe.
Right.
And for instance, It, with a very similar tone, I think the series The Good Place deals with a lot of similar themes as this film in a number of different ways. And a lot of what they did in that show, which I think I thought was a wonderful show, and I thought it was very heartwarming, and I think it was dealt with very delicately. But they don't necessarily talk specifically about a god or a creator as much as the idea of having lived a good life and doing good things. In fact, in Defending Your Life, the movie we're talking about, there is one reference to God that I can remember that Albert Brooks makes. So I'm just wondering, like I said, there are people I know who are very devout, who will resist seeing, no matter how good the show might be or how much the intention is there to kind of represent this movie, is somewhat non-denominational from the standpoint that it is trying to talk in more general terms about having lived a good life and how that affects what happens to you next. So how do you balance that in kind of watching this and your feelings as a Christian?
That's a great question. You know, I mean, I always, and I talk about this on my podcast as well, I always say, know more than you want to know, and know what you believe and why you believe it. And if you know what you believe and why you believe it, you can always stand firm in everything and you can be exposed to all sorts of things and it doesn't matter. And if you know more than you want to know, meaning that's what we tend to do, I think, especially in these days, where we just want to be fed what we like and what we approve of.
Yeah.
But I constantly challenge myself to be exposed to things that are not what I like or approve of, because that's real life. And that's the only way to find common ground with people and to find forgiveness or to find love and compassion, because everybody's story is the same. Generally speaking, I don't think anybody on this planet that is of right mind, you know, has thoughts that are opposite of you just to be opposite or to make you mad or to, it's like, it's just what they believe. So I really love watching things that give a different spin than what I believe, because it's like, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I'm still secure in what I believe, but that's interesting. And isn't that funny? And can't that be charming? And can't that be even something we can learn and grow from? I mean, you know, personally, as a Christian, I feel like everything's been ripped off from God anyway, so I'm not offended by it. You know, it's like he created it all, so, you know, whatever. Of course people are going to rip him off. People rip everybody off. So, you know, that's my take on, you know, various other belief systems or what have you. And I'm not, but that's not a, like a, oh, you know, everybody else is just an idiot and I know the truth. It's, of course, we all think we know the truth. That's, I mean, that's the other thing. That's part of humanity, right? We just think we're right. So there's, you just have to have a sense of humor about it. You have to go into it knowing I may be right, I may be wrong. I have to be open.
Well, I think there's something with a movie like this, I think there's something to be said for if the core values of the message of the film match yours, then you have to give it some
credence, absolutely.
Yeah, you have to recognize that what they're espousing still reconciles with what your core beliefs are, even if they aren't down to the exacting details of.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you look at the Christian faith. I mean, you've got so many different denominations, and you know, I'm Lutheran, but if you were brought up Catholic, it's like,
oh wow, I didn't realize that, James. Well, we're done. Okay, bye.
see what happened.
See what we did.
But that's just it. So there's always different belief systems on it. But, you know, I mean, at the core of the Christian belief system, there will be a day of judgment, you know,
right,
for all of us. Right. So this film is a very fun, funny exercise and look at that. And how will I hold up?
Right.
How will I measure up?
Well,
I mean,
virtually all faiths have that inherently built into it. And I think that's another thing that, and if you haven't figured it out, Albert Brooks is in fact Jewish, although he didn't necessarily, he was more of a cultural Jew, I think, than, you know, any sort of practicing or Orthodox Jew. But I think what another brilliant thing he did was that he did incorporate elements of virtually all faith-based doctrine in some way.
Yeah. In some way in there. No,
they are represented in again in very light sketches, but there's a lot in there, and I'm also surprised that for a movie that's you know, kind of where are we looking at? It's like almost 20 years old now, right?
Yeah. Well, it's over 20 years old.
Yeah. There's very
1991.
Oh, geez,
it's
really?
Almost 30 years old.
Oh, good Lord. Oh. Don't ever do the math, James. That just makes me old.
Well, see, I know, because that's the year I was married, and I will be in another year or so. It'll be 30 years.
There you go. I should have figured it out, because that's the year my son was born. So I should have gotten that right. But it doesn't. It's aged pretty well. I mean, there are a couple of things with some Asian stereotypes that are a little uncomfortable, but
the sushi bar? Oh, it's hysterical.
It's funny, but also he also makes a joke about something about I looked Chinese because I was squinting so much. And that was a rough one.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. But there are so many movies from 20 to 30 years ago that are like, no, we can't watch them.
Well, which, I mean, like one of my all-time favorite movies, which was normally I would have said this is my first choice on this, is the movie Arthur, the original with Dudley Moore and John Gielgud.
Yes.
But, you know, he's a drunk in that, and that is not politically correct now at all.
It's rough. Yeah. There are so many movies that we have. Alex and I actually watched Animal House because...
Oh, yeah.
And it is so funny so much of the time and so perfectly timed, and Belushi is such a force of nature to watch, and there are so many surprisingly subtle moments of comedy in there from Peter Riegert and Tim Matheson, some physical gags and timing that John Landis pulled off brilliantly. And there's so much of it that's so wrong now and so tough to watch in our current climate. And I feel guilty about laughing at something that I shouldn't be laughing at. So it's you know, when you have to go back and revisit some of this stuff. I mean, nobody could ever make Airplane in this day and age.
Oh, no. With no, you sure couldn't.
About 70% of those jokes you can't do now.
Isn't that crazy?
Well,
man.
So James, I think now would be a great time because you, as I said, you had a great go-to list that you have probably been powering through. And I would imagine that some of these involve showing your daughter for the first time as she has reached a certain age where there are maybe some movies that maybe you're like, okay, I think maybe now's a good time for you to see so-and-so.
Like Love Actually was one that we really held on to for a while because of one of the most charming storylines in Love Actually, which of course I'm sure everybody knows Love Actually, but there's all these stories that kind of come together. But one of the most charming stories in it is the one that I was the most fearful of showing her because it's these two extras on a film set that are the stand-ins for the stars, and they're having to get lighting and stuff checked while they're pretending to make love or have sex.
Right.
I mean, we don't even say make love. They are having sex.
Yeah.
And they're naked half the time and stuff. So I was like, ugh. You know, so we had to like kind of talk to her like, okay, there's a scene. I don't really know how, you know, there's some stuff in it. But we have been having such a blast showing her some of our favorite films. And the one that I really struggled with, it was either Defending Your Life or this one, which is one of my just absolute all-time, it's one of the most perfect films. It's called Return to Me, and it's David Duchovny and Minnie Driver.
Oh,
and
yes.
It is Bonnie Hunt directed it and wrote it, and it is one of the most beautiful, fun, perfect movies you'll ever see.
Oh man, I haven't thought of that in forever, James. That is such a great recommendation, and it is also, it is so bittersweet, but so it fulfills
O'Connor,
its yes. Oh my
Robert
gosh,
Robert Loggia, David Alan Grier. You got James Belushi is hysterical in it. It is so sweet and funny. All generations. And Lydia, my daughter, loved it. We watch this movie probably a couple times a year. We love it so much.
Right.
And I've been able to friend Bonnie Hunt on Twitter and such and send her little notes and stuff, as well as the other person, Don Lake, that she wrote the movie with.
Right.
I've worked with Don before and got to tell him how much this movie means to me. It is a sweet, sweet movie.
Bonnie Hunt, another name that unfortunately might get lost to some generations who don't know what a comic talent she was and was always underutilized. But anything she was ever involved with, she's the best part of it. And she got to direct this movie. I can't believe she didn't get to do more.
I know.
Man, what a great one.
So everybody, I believe it's on like Amazon or Netflix or something right now. So everybody should watch Return to Me in this day and this time because it's so sweet. It'll make you laugh really hard. It'll make you cry like,
oh man, I'm just tearing up thinking about the story. Just, all right. It's Return to Me from 2000, David Duchovny, Minnie Driver, directed by Bonnie Hunt. She is in it as well. That is a great recommendation, James. Oh, yeah. So good.
It is laugh out loud funny at times, too. And it's just David Duchovny at his absolute best, you know, because he is just so sweet in this. And you love all of them. It's great. But the scenes with Carol O'Connor and Robert Loggia and all the old guys that work at this Italian, that own this Italian restaurant.
Right, right.
O'Reilly's Italian restaurant. It is so sweet and lovely. And I just recommend it highly.
So fun.
But,
excellent.
Yes. So Arthur, Return to Me, Defending Your Life, kind of the top ones. Then Sideways.
Oh, yes.
Sideways.
The Wine Country movie.
Absolutely. And it was shot near where I grew up in Santa Barbara. And we just love that movie. We play the soundtrack to that movie all the time
in
the house because it's just a great jazz soundtrack.
If you ever want to see Paul Giamatti at his Giamattiest, that's the movie.
Gosh.
I mean,
Sideways. Yeah, not really great for all. Like, we haven't shown that one to my daughter yet because there's a couple scenes. There's some nudity and stuff in there that's actually very funny. But
it's definitely an adult film. But
it's an R-rated film. Yes.
Yeah. But man, it's so good.
And then one of the other ones that's rated R, and I don't really know why. I guess maybe some F-bombs or something. But we showed it to my daughter recently because she loves the soundtrack, and it's called About Time. and it's from the maker of Love Actually, and it is a brilliant, brilliant movie, and it is about
Bill Nighy. This is like a time travel film.
It's a time travel movie, but it's a love story, and it's not anything like what we just said. The explanation, you may go, time travel love story? No. No. It is one of the most charming movies just about family. It's really about fathers and sons and daughters, and yet there's this weird kind of time travel element to it.
Yes. And it's appropriate that you mention it with some of these others, because it is written by Richard Curtis, who wrote Love Actually and Bridget Jones, Four Weddings at a Funeral, Notting Hill. So if any of those movies resonate with you and you haven't seen About Time, it is absolutely lovely. Wow. Rachel McAdams and Donald Gleason, right?
Yep. Yeah, Donald Gleason. Yeah,
Donald.
He's great.
Donald.
There are some moments. Bill Nighy is so sweet and wonderful. As somebody that grew up not having a father figure, I watch this and I just long for these moments that they have in this. It's so charming, and everybody's British, so it makes it all the more charming.
That's a plus. Absolutely.
It's like, About Time, Love Actually, About a Boy. That's another one that is one of my favorites.
Love that movie.
And then there's, Tootsie is also one of my absolute all-time favorite movies of all time. We've watched that. I've watched that a couple times recently.
It's such a well-done comedy. It's unfortunately, I don't know how much of the sexual dynamics have aged very well, but man, it is such a finely crafted comedy from top to bottom. It's so good.
Yeah, my daughter watches. She goes, I liked it, but I don't really get into all that gender stuff once, you know.
Yeah.
She's like, because now it's a whole other argument or a whole other thing now about gender. It's not, you know, so much about a guy dressing up as a girl.
Right.
It, you know, so in her mind, it was a different film. So, yeah, she was like, yeah, it was fine.
Yeah.
But Parenthood, we just showed her a couple nights ago.
Oh, great.
She loved that. Parenthood was great. Not the TV show, but the movie that it was based on.
Yeah, with Steve Martin and Rick Moranis.
Rick Moranis.
Who I miss terribly.
And Tom Hulce and Jason Robards.
Directed by Ron Howard.
Directed by Ron Howard, yeah. Now, so, and let me just very quickly say, though, because there's different genres that I have my favorites in. First, like thrillers, The Game, and Reversal of Fortune are my two favorites. The Game with Michael Douglas, it's a
so good. And Sean Penn, yeah.
Sean Penn, really good. We just showed that to my daughter the other night, and she really liked it.
If you like a good twisty kind of turny thing, oh, wow, that's good.
And then Reversal of Fortune, Jeremy Irons, who won the Oscar for that.
Yes.
And Glenn Close. The True Story of Klaus von Bülow. It is such a well-crafted movie. And Ron Silver playing Dershowitz.
Yes.
But then, let's see, what else? Oh, My Life. For a drama, it's Michael, why did his name just go out of my head? I was going to say Michael Douglas. It's not Michael Douglas. It's, hang on.
Are we talking about the Billy Joel tune from
No, the movie My Life.
Life. Keaton.
It's Michael Keaton. I'm sorry. Michael Keaton and Nicole Kidman it's one of the sweet. And it's, again, this is a great example of, you know, I'm a person of Christian faith. This movie is not about that. It's more about, like, you know, more of a Buddhist kind of look at life and stuff. This man has cancer. He's dying. His son is about to be born, and he makes videotapes for his son to see who he was before he dies. Mm-hmm. But he's this successful ad man out in Hollywood. And it's all about letting go of fear and stuff too. It's kind of like the serious version of defending your life. And I really love the movie, and it's one of my favorites for a good, sweet kind of tearjerker.
Excellent.
And then Magnolia, the film Magnolia.
Oh, wow. Okay. There's a left turn I didn't expect. Holy cow.
Yeah. That, I will throw Magnolia on when I want to get, there's something about that movie. It's very, very heavy and all sorts of things going on. But man, is it a great, well-crafted film. I mean, I would say the same of Boogie Nights. Now, that's a very heavy, you know.
Yeah.
That's not one you're going to show the kids. Neither is Magnolia necessarily. But man, is Paul Thomas Anderson a brilliant filmmaker.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. Those two in particular, I have a real affection for. I have a weird relationship with Paul Thomas Anderson, but I tell you, if Boogie Nights comes on, or Magnolia for that matter, those two, and I think that's a lot. Pete Siegel and I were talking about this too. It's like, they're the kind of movies, if you find them on some channel somewhere, you will pick it up and watch it no matter what. And exactly. No matter where it is in the film, because you just can't help but be drawn in. And Boogie Nights has always been that way for me. Magnolia has also got that capacity.
I'm wondering if it's because it's not so much about what it's about, the theme of adult films. It's about the time period that they captured so well. And it was the time that we grew up. I'm much older than you, Larry. No,
I wish.
It reminds me of that time period so well, just like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood did. I thought it was just such a great slice of that time period.
I think so much of it is storytelling. And to me, it's like you drop into something like that, Boogie Nights in particular, because it is immersed in a different time period, but also the momentum of the movie the way it's told, it just comes down to having your finger on the pulse of how cinema works. I mean, the way you tell a story, if you can pull you in the middle and you're still interested, even if you don't know remember everything that's going on, that just says something about the filmmaker as a storyteller, that he can grab you no matter what point of the movie. And that's kind of what Boogie Nights has always been for me. It's like, I will sit there fascinated. Pete Siegel and I talked about Tarantino in the same way. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, for him, Inglourious Bastards is the same. It's like, drop you in the middle of that one and you're like, okay, I got to see this to the end because I know what's coming.
And I know it's good because my wife feels the same about those. Like, she enjoys them, and she doesn't necessarily like, violent movies or anything too.
Right.
But Alfred Molina in Boogie Nights, that's all you got to say.
That scene.
They never made Jesse's Girl by Rick Springfield seem more terrifying.
Yeah. Or Sister Christian by Night Ranger have such dread to it. Yes.
Yeah. So honorable mentions. Also, another one we watch quite often is I Love You, Man, with Paul Rudd and
fantastic.
Jason Segel.
Fantastic.
It is comfort food. It's like Freaks and Geeks, and it's made kind of in that by the same kind of group of folks in that regard.
Right.
It's just so good and so funny. Jaws is another one.
That's one of mine.
It's
absolutely
about a killer shark, but man, I haven't shown it to my daughter yet because she still likes going in the ocean, and I just don't want to ruin that for her.
We are never going to get to go back in the ocean again. I think it's okay.
Here's one I don't know if you've ever seen, and I'm gonna challenge you to watch it at some point if you get a chance. It's called Shattered Glass.
Oh yes,
it stars Hayden Christensen. It is Stephen Glass was a reporter, and
this is a true story.
Stories.
By the way,
it's a true story. He faked stories to get in papers, in the magazines and stuff, and he made stuff up, and it shows how far somebody that goes down the path of kind of like psychological, pathological lying will go. And it's really an astounding story to see this kind of person and this type of actions in somebody's life. It's really interesting.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
How much longer is your list, James?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Well, pretty much all of John Hughes's movies from the, Ferris Bueller and Breakfast Club and all of those, Weird Science even, I love all that. But when I want to feel good and fun, we love The Greatest Showman as a new one. That's one of our new
Very
ones.
Nice. Very
yeah,
nice.
I really enjoy that. But we also just showed my daughter Austin Powers movies, Wayne's World, and The Wedding Singer. And The Wedding Singer is one of my wife and I's favorite comfort foods as well.
That's great. Oh, these are great. And so we only have like, I don't know, 3 more months to fill time to go. So we're going to be going through all this list. James, this has been a delight, and I should mention that Defending Your Life is available on all the streaming platforms right now if you want to check it out. James and I both highly recommend this as a lovely movie, pretty much for the whole family. It's a romantic comedy. It is very funny and ends with such a nice, heartwarming moment that I think you'll really enjoy it. It is also available for free right now if you are a Spectrum subscriber, I believe. Oh. And it's also on HBO Now or HBO Go on demand.
Yes, that's right.
So excellent. James, couldn't be happier to talk to you. I know that we're going to roll right into your podcast here. So if you're not sick of talking to me yet, we got a little more time to go here. But thank you so much. Is there anything we need to know about what's going on with you other than the only thing I'm going to ask you is, how does Clone Wars end?
I can't tell you that.
No, you can't.
No,
nobody's
can't.
Listening. No, James.
Oh, sure.
Obi-Wan has apparently been popping up here and there throughout.
He has, and people have been very gracious and kind, saying how much they love it. We are at a point, there's only two episodes left of Clone Wars now on Disney Plus.
What's going to happen?
I'm not telling you.
Okay.
But it is very much, we are now in the storyline where it is connecting and going on at the same time as Revenge of the Sith, the film. So,
do you know what happens?
I know what happens. Because I was there. But I can't tell you.
But you could, though.
I can't.
But you could.
I can't. Not if
James,
I ever want to work
James,
again.
Shh.
They're always
James. What happens?
Okay. You ready?
Oh, yeah.
Anakin Skywalker turns into Darth Vader. There you go.
Oh, well.
Sorry.
What? Okay, spoiler
Palpatine
alert.
Is actually the Emperor.
Okay.
Palpatine is the Emperor.
All right. You know what? We're done. James Arnold Taylor, tell everybody where they can find you, your YouTube channel, your own podcast. Although most people listening right now already know because you have way more fans than I do, but just remind everybody.
Well, you can go to jamesarnoldtaylor.com. That's kind of your one stop there to find all the links. But you can follow me on social media. All of it is the same. It's hashtag, or it's a handle is at JatActor, J-A-T actor, because I have the longest name in show business. And you can go to my YouTube channel and search for me there and subscribe to the channel, please. It's free. My podcast is on there, and there are literally hundreds of videos on my YouTube channel that I've made through the last several years, including one based on my book that I wrote, Jat 365, which is 365 Daily Inspirations for the Pursuit of Your Dreams. It is, you can walk with me daily for a year through positive little things that I give you, little pep talks that I give you that are about 60 to 90 seconds long. And those are on the YouTube channel. Plus, one's in the booth. You can watch me doing my voiceover. You can listen to my podcast, which is called Talking to Myself, which is also the name of my stage show that I have that I've taken all over the world and toured with. It's my life as a voice actor, and I tell stories, and I do about 200 voices in it. And my podcast is the same name, and I do a bunch of characters on that show, including ones that I created with you back in the day in radio.
That's right.
And so it's a lot of fun. It's me doing all of it. It's very similar to another guest you've had on the show, Phil Hendry. It's very similar to what Phil does. He is brilliant at it, and I just am basically having conversations with myself, and all the characters are me on the show.
Yeah.
And so it's a lot of fun, and you can find that on wherever you podcast as well as on my YouTube channel.
Yeah, if you want a visual of the personification of somebody who works in voiceover going insane in the middle of a quarantine, then watch James do his podcast. Watch the promo, the trailer for it, because, that's nuts. It was the same way when watching Phil Hendry work, and I went, this is just making me nervous because I feel like I'm watching somebody in the middle of a nervous breakdown. I can't imagine how this is happening. James, I love you. I love your family. Please give my best to you, yours, and you. And you. Give my best to you and yours.
Yes. You, me, go.
Pass along to you, and I love you, and you are such a good friend, and even across the distance, I am so happy that we were able to connect today. It's a good excuse for us to sit here and talk about movies we love for an hour, so what's better than that?
Well, we could have talked for 12 hours, probably.
For a minute there, it felt like it was going to be, so...
You are the one person in my life, Larry, I mean this with all my heart, that I instantly become funnier and better when I'm around. Honestly. Yeah. I've always said that. I've always noticed that. I'm like, I am so much funnier and better when I'm around Larry. So that's God bless you. I
love
you as well.
Means a lot to me. Thank you so much. Thanks for spending the time. And we'll talk again.
Okay.
All right. Stay healthy. Be safe.
Yes.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.